Morning, Frankie, how are you?
Good morning.
Do you notice I tell him Mr. Chair and I call you Frankie?
Good morning, colleagues. The Joint Committee on Tax Reform for May 18th, 2017will come to order. Colleagues, we're continuing our conversation about the potential tax reforms, that being the name of the committee. And we're going to hear again from our own Dr. Paul Warner.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. We've got some additional material for you. I just wanted to say a couple of things before we look into at some more of the OTIM output. As I put in OLIS an article out of State Tax Notes called State Experiences with Dynamic Revenue Analysis. And I think this is a pretty good summary of what the states do to try to incorporate economic effects or indirect effects. And I know Senator Taylor was asking for additional background on kind of where we get this analysis. And it's a good comparison. A lot of states use an off-the-shelf model called REMI that we have. And that was used, the Northwest Economic Research Center at Portland State uses REMI as well, and we've worked with them. And maybe with the carbon tax study was done a couple of years ago. So the REMI has been used by a number of states. There are two states now that have their own general equilibrium model. It's us and Nebraska, and I don't know what else we have in common with Nebraska, but we do have that. And basically, both of those models, our OTIM model and their TRAIN model, came from the work of the California Department of Finance. They built what's called the DRAM, Dynamic Revenue Analysis Model, and we both benefited from that experience and worked with the folks in Sacramento. The Department of Finance doesn't use their DRAM model anymore. They haven't updated it, so it's just us in Nebraska that maintain those models. But a number of states are doing this kind of analysis with off-the-shelf software. So, and I also put out a couple pages on OLIS titled Analytical Tools. That's from our tax reform options a couple years ago, kind of describes OTIM in general. So as we go through, if you have questions about what things mean, I'm happy to talk about those and try to clarify those to make sure. But first thing I wanted to talk about was the draft tax reform plan we talked about last week and do some enhancements to it based on the questions that you had asked. This is just the basic numbers again. There's some very slight differences in it. We updated it for the forecast that you got on Tuesday. So, and we re-ran that through the OTIM model based on those changes. So those are the basic numbers that we're looking at. It's a $250 minimum, $1 million threshold, a flat 0.48% rate. We are looking at some versions that have tiered rates, for example, services versus goods. And so we're starting to work on those and would anticipate getting some of that analysis to you soon. Then we also have an income tax reduction, which is essentially a 0.5% for each of the brackets except for the 9.9. And you can see the static results there. What we do in terms of the OTIM analysis is we take those static results, and that's what we input into the model. So we estimate what those are for the base year of the model, which is 2017. So we put that in, use the economic variables we currently have in the system, and then start from that point forward in terms of the analysis. The next table was really some questions. I think in particular, Senator Boquist had some questions around the employment impacts and how those break out. We do have detailed output of every simulation we run. It produces a lot of output. And this is the sectors that we have, so it gives you an idea of what they are. These are roughly NAICS sectors that you're familiar with, I think, somewhat. And if we are to look at differential rates, for example, we would use these sectors to apply them and use a NAICS code to implement them in terms of the statutory language, much you call the definitions that Nevada used in their commerce tax. So these are the breakdowns. You can see the question that was asked, and we had a dynamic revenue impact of all said and done, about 7,500 in terms of overall employment. And you can see that 7,460 in terms of the details of the model. And the question was, in particular, how much of that was in the public sector? What we do with the model, remember, this is demand side, and I'll get to some of the productivity or supply side potential effects in a minute, but we just have two general categories. We have education and we have non-education. So we don't have a detailed spending side, and of course, and then for us as the revenue office, we have a very detailed revenue side. So we can look at any very minute specific taxes within the system. That's all driven off of census data. So we can look at those details, but on the spending side, we just have these two categories. And so what we did in terms of the increased revenue, we just basically split it evenly between education and non-education. And you can see that the employment effects are an increase of about 4,300. So of that 7,500, 4,300 was public sector. And then you can see there are some sectors that had losses and some that had gains. The gains tended to come in some of the bigger sectors that were more labor intensive. I think they were benefiting in particular from the lower income tax rates at the bottom end. Remember what happens in this model is that we saw how the wage actually goes down. The nominal wage goes down, but the real wage or the take-home wage goes up because you have a lower marginal tax rate. Well, some of these lower wage sectors, you're getting gains because those are the folks that are responding to the higher take-home pay. And the employers are responding because the nominal wage that they pay is less. So you got to kind of get a squeezing of that gap as supply responds and demand responds to that lower nominal wage. So that's how it works itself out, and that's, you can see some of the bigger sectors. You can see some that do have some negatives. They, like food processing, for example, and I would interpret that as potentially some negative effects from pyramiding that may happen in that sector where you have a lot of transactions. So there's potential there. But in general, you see that with the combination of the corporate income tax elimination, the lower personal income tax rates, you in general see most sectors do have a relatively small but a positive employment impact. And overall, the private sector employment's up about 3,200 in this estimate.
Senator Boquist, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, if you scroll to the bottom, I'm looking at the government, state government, local government, and I'm following up on the good representative to my far left's question the other day that we had this discussion on in regards to how many of these jobs are replacement jobs, how many of these jobs are new jobs. And I look very specifically, and the easiest one to track, and I'm asking really if you can come back with data in concert with our Joint Ways and Means folks, is the easiest thing, if you look at Oregon state government spending non-education, it says it creates 1,717 new jobs. That's right there where your cursor's at. Most of us, even that are on Joint Ways and Means, know what the FTEs are, and we know there isn't a proposal anywhere to create 1,700 new jobs, even if we got this money. So my question is there some sort of effort, and the other thing we can do before I ask the question is that we can restrict through the budgeting process the growth in FTE. So those 1,717 jobs, we can prevent those from being hired, frankly, through the appropriations process to ensure the money spent where we wanted to spend it if we're going to do this. My question, though, is there that anomaly in which it says we're going to create 1,700 jobs, in which we know at state government we're not, because we have not done that necessarily in the past, in theory, and we also know we have tons of vacant jobs right now that have not filled and used the money elsewhere. But down in the education sector, and I think LFO does a little bit of this, but in those 2,031 jobs which are down there, is there a mechanism or is there a scientific wild guess here from LFO in which we can try to identify how many of those would actually be new jobs and how many jobs would be lost if we didn't do it. You follow my train of thought here? I think the chair doesn't grasp it.
Senator Boqvist, yeah, I think there's a couple of things there. One is that, again, these estimates are based on our current position and where we would be in 5 years compared to the current law forecast. So if the current law forecast has reductions in education employment, then what we're saying is those reductions would be less, or there may be it would come off of this gain that's projected here. So this is all in the context of our current law forecast that you got on Tuesday. So keep that in mind. It takes a 5-year period. So those are two of the caveats. The other thing is that these are calculated just looking at the current ratio in the base between employment and overall revenue. So if we have a X number of employees per dollar of revenue, that's what the model is going to spit out. So it's not certainly not a management tool by any means. It's just kind of a general direction of what would happen if the current pattern remains in place, the current ratio of employment to revenue.
Yeah, please.
And my point on this and the importance of this information is that we're all assuming at some point, I'll be optimistic, when we do some sort of reform, being optimistic, Mr. Chair, that there are other silos out there that come together. And one of those, of course, is cost containment. I know in the cost containment, every one of the single cost containment proposals says basically we live within our existing FTE. Doesn't mean we don't change them. Doesn't mean we don't retrain them. We reprioritize them. But it has built into that basic cost containment theory is we're not going to grow 1,700 new positions in the next couple of years, especially considering the number of vacant positions that we have along the line. I'm just trying to say at some point before we do something, when that is, that these silos have to start merging together, and especially in the realm of at least those of us who do think that we need to have lower classroom sizes at the bottom end of the spectrum. We want to be able to ensure whatever we do in revenue, our colleagues in joint ways and means are compelled by what we do, and there's ways to do that, to make sure it's done the proper way.
Thank you. Senator Taylor, please.
Thank you, Chair Bernhardt. So just following up on what Senator Boqvist was talking about, when we are looking at spending on education, Paul, I would like to have it be very explicit if any data that comes back of where the starting point is. So I always get concerned when we talk about using data as we use in the building of what point is it being compared to. So the one could look at the education potential investment here, as I would look at it, for spending on education dollars, be it at the state level or the local level. One could look at pre-Measure 5. People could look at everything since Measure 5. People could look at it from what the QEM says. This could be looked at, and there could be a lot of different starting points. So the idea of whether or not we need those more, not that Senator Boqvist was suggesting that we didn't need money spent on education, because I don't think you were suggesting that. He was talking about government jobs, and I'm focusing on the education part of this data, because I think all of our eyes automatically go to those larger numbers. Mm-hmm. But I see this as a very beneficial for public education throughout the state to be able to have this kind of investment, because we hear from our constituents all the time from the school districts that they need more bodies to not just teachers, teaching assistants, et cetera, throughout the whole state. So I think this is something positive. So I just wanted to make certain that we're mindful of any kind of data that comes back of like where the starting point is, especially in regards to education for FTE, please.
Senator, yeah, I think we're headed in that direction these next two SIMs to look at what potential you may have in terms of if that public sector spending ends up increasing the productivity of the economy overall. And that's what our next two SIMs look at. But in terms of where we start from, our base for our model is from something called M-Plan, which uses census-type data to project the base. We then blow that up to the current level, and then that becomes the base for comparison. You can see in terms of the local government education spending, and of course, the state, when the state spends money through the state school fund, that doesn't add much to state employment. It adds to local education. So you can see our starting point is 137,000 in terms of the baseline we get from our in-plan model. About 137,000 gets bumped up to about 139,000 in the simulation. So if I may, Mr. Chair, I can go on and...
Well, we have a couple more questions.
Oh, okay.
Representative Hernandez, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just to follow up on some of the line of questioning, is there any way we can understand how past economic impacts on particularly the education sector and how that has consequently done to the available jobs and or available job opportunities based on the graduation rates? So for the most part, I'm looking for data that shows the correlation between what our graduation rate is and how that impacts those that are private sector growth, how that impacts the growth of our economy. You know, from my perspective, having served on the school board and continuing to do so, and having to lay off in the past recession hundreds of teachers and hundreds of educational assistants, there are consequences, I believe, to the local economy and the state economy. So I'm looking for data that shows if you invest into the education, and maybe it's not short term because this is definitely short term, but is there a correlation that the more you invest in education, the more the private sector grows, that there's actually skilled labor? If that's so, you know, is there data to prove it?
Representative Hernandez, we will take a look at the literature. There is a lot of literature on that. There's a lot of, you know, what the economy grows over time for two reasons. One is there's more resources out there, more capital. We get increase in the labor force, and so just kind of a quantity increase. But the real driver behind long-term economic growth is productivity, and we know that productivity affects the wage. Because if you have a more productive labor force, wages in economic theory are equal to the value of the marginal product, whereas the marginal product is labor productivity times the value of whatever it is the workers are producing. So firms are able to pay more if those workers are more productive, and we know that productivity of labor productivity is tied to education. So it is obviously a key factor in long-term growth. So, and then we'll take a look at some of the state-level literature and come back with some material for you. But I've also seen quite a few studies that tie it back to revenue, where, you know, what if you're doing, just kind of an investment in terms of the public sector, we spend money here, how much do we get in additional tax revenue? And I've seen studies like that in which if you have workers that are more productive get paid more, of course they're going to pay more in income tax down the road. So we'll go through a review of that and bring back some material for the committee.
Co-Chair Hess, please.
Thank you. I think Senator Boquist makes an excellent point on the government spending side. And I think, and I'm not asking you to plug these in, Paul, but the cost containment package that we're working on, I hope we pass, does have some limits on hiring, temporary hiring freeze, tying the percentage to a smaller percentage that's in law now, 1%. And I'm just wondering if, it's worth considering, as has been discussed at some places, dedicating all of the proceeds from this reform to education, say, and how that would change that. So I think that's something to consider. I don't want to lose sight, though, that this, of the fact that 3,200 private jobs that are created through this is a positive benefit, and investment is up. And this was like our first swing here. And that's just you don't see that in tax changes very often, but it's that wide net bringing in outside money combined with the income tax cuts. There are, I am cognizant, though, of some of the, you know, losses in some of these sectors. In your opinion, Paul, is that something that could be addressed wholesale, particularly food processing, by a tiered structure so we have a lower rate for wholesale, a higher rate for service and goods?
Mr. Co-Chair, I think that they could be partially addressed through that. You can see, and of course, this was a sector that we saw when we've looked at gross receipts taxes in the past, is the wholesale trade sector tends to get hit. So that's one we can look at. And I think where this is happening is you've got a wholesale trade sector that is purchasing and selling within the state, but also selling outside the state. So it ends up losing some of its competitive position because of its kind of dual role that it plays in the state as a distribution center. We've talked about Ohio's policy of singling out qualified distribution centers to try to protect potential impacts on exporters. So those kinds of things would certainly be part of a detailed bill that you'd look at. We are working on that, some of those issues now.
So. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Paul, I guess I'm two questions. First of all, on your modeling and how it would show a greater percentage of new revenues going to education versus non-education, because that really is different than what we've seen over the last several biennia, going from the 2003-05, I think, where K-12 was getting almost 45% of the general fund, and now we're close to 38. So the trend certainly hasn't gone that direction. The emphasis has been more on the human services side, which, so I'm just wondering how your model gets this distribution of any additional revenues.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Johnson, these numbers are employment. So the education sector is labor intensive, and it's state or it's government employees, teachers. So I think that's what's showing up there. They have a higher ratio on the employment side than they do some of the other sectors or some of the other agencies like DHS, for example, that have a lot of transfer payments. So they're making transfer payments, and so their labor component is less than, for example, education, where they're actually producing the service in the classroom.
And the follow-up would be, you mentioned earlier you're going to be working on some tiering data or some formula for it. Could you talk specifically about what kind of tiering structures you're going to be looking at as we try to apply this across the economy?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Johnson, the first thing we have been looking at is to take, start from the B&O chart that you've seen about industry sector, and just break it up into services. And of course, you recall the B&O has a higher rate on services than others, where we looked at services compared to basically everything else, where we have a rate for retail, wholesale, manufacturing, construction that's all lower than services. And of course, the theory there that drives the decision in Washington is that there's a lot less pyramiding that goes on at the service sector. You don't have as many of those intermediate transactions that you would in wholesaling or food processing, those kinds of things. So that's the basic element we've looked at. If you look at these sectors, I mean, in terms of the model, we can have a different rate for each sector, but we would worry about running into complexity in terms of administering it. So, but I think that's the basic breakdown, services versus everything else, and then as Senator Hass had mentioned, to maybe look at some areas around distribution, warehousing, that kind of thing, where you could perhaps have a lower rate. If you look at the B&O system, it's, the retail, wholesale, and manufacturing all kind of clustered around 0.48. And then there's some very specific ones that probably have grown up through legislative decisions historically. And then services is the one that's way higher than the others. So we'll look at that kind of structure, and then we can make some variations off that.
Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Paul, it looks like most of the job losses are concentrated in traditional manufacturing, which I assume is due to pyramiding. Is that a correct assumption?
Mr. Co-Chair, or simply there, you know, if you look at the bigger manufacturing, like semiconductor, for example, actually has increases. But yeah, the more traditional ones, such as wood and construction products has a loss, food processing has a loss, other, which includes various kinds of metals and things, have a loss too. So I think there's some truth to that, but you can see a lot of the manufacturing sectors are either even or have slight gains.
So I'm having a hard time understanding why some of the manufacturing sector sees job losses. Most of the manufacturing sector sees, or some of the manufacturing sector, more the high-tech manufacturing sector, appears to have job gains, and the mm-hmm. traditional seems to have job losses. What's different between those two different manufacturing sectors?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Buehler, the OTM is a input-output model, so it ties each sector to other sectors. So I suspect what's happening here is that these sectors have more connections with other sectors, and so more intermediate transactions. And those greater number of intermediate transactions increases the possibility that you'll have taxable events through the gross receipts tax, whereas the semiconductor industry and others have less of those.
So that'd be another way of saying that those high-tech manufacturers are more vertically integrated, and they don't have as much transactions with their suppliers as more smaller manufacturers.
Well, I think there's two things. I think that's partially true, but I think the other issue is they are probably more likely to have suppliers outside of the state. So in that case, then the supply chain spreads over a wider variety, a wider range, and so you're less likely to get pyramiding in that case.
Thank you. Senator Boquist?
I want to go back to the education piece so that we have clarity. when you and I, Mr. Chair, first met, was 2005, and we were both on the House Revenue Committee. And Chair Buehler was...
Actually, we were on the Veterans Committee together.
Yeah. Actually, no, you were on the Revenue Committee in 2005, too. I believe that's correct, and at that point,
you two need a moment.
Yeah, we do. Need a moment. It is certainly the exact reason why this is going to hit a brick wall if we don't think outside of the box. And in that session, the education mantra was this classroom size, and we are now 12 years later, and we're all talking about classroom size. And I would be surprised if anyone here at this diocese would disagree that the classroom size at the early learning level is the most important issue, because those fundamental basic educational blocks as we go forward. It is very clear from the voters that they didn't believe that 97 was going to be applied to education. And we, the legislature, being the scoundrels we sometimes are, would take that money and spend it someplace else. And so I fully appreciate what the good chair on the Senate side has said is about, dedicating to education. But I think the voters out there figured out we're not very good at that. And so therefore they passed, everything from outdoor school to additional funding, because they don't trust the legislature. They don't trust the executive branch, and no disrespect to my colleagues, because I was involved in school boards too. They don't trust the school boards either. And so, whatever we decide to do going forward, this whole discussion around not creating more state-level jobs and ensuring that whatever money goes to K-12, if that's the place we're going to put it, which is the logical place, needs to be spent on fixing the problem, not perpetuating the existing structure. And I think that's exactly the reason we have all the ballot measures, and it's the problem we're going to face, because remember, no matter what we do is referable, and there's not much difference unless we come up with a proposal at some point that says we're going to actually fix something, not just throw money at it. And the issue has been classroom sizes at the lower level, and that's what the public believes, and that's regardless of what we do, if we pass it out of this building and we haven't come up with a solution that's believable by the public, we're going to be right back in here doing it again, those of us that might be left after the recalls. So I would just urge everybody to remember we've been at this 12 years. So just saying education doesn't fix it.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Are we ready to go on to the next piece?
Yes.
I think we are.
I'll just show real quickly the SIM-4.
While he's moving along, let me just comment quickly. We're talking about employment at the beginning of 2.5 million, slightly more than that. We're talking about employment at the end of 2.5 million, slightly more than that. The difference is 7,000. This change actually has a minuscule effect on the general direction of the economy, doesn't it?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
This is what you saw last week. We call it Simulation 4. And just to remind you of the results, we did plug in the draft plan you saw. There is a slight decline in per capita income of $62. You get an employment gain of $7,500, you saw. You do get an investment increase of $33 million, and your price level is up 0.15%. So a portion of this increase does filter through to prices, but only a portion. And so those are the other thing to point out is the dynamic revenue feedback is minuscule, but it's negative, -4. So when we look at these SEMs, we assume that this is roughly a 5-year period. Now, it depends on where you are in the business cycle and so forth. But that's our assumption, is that it takes about 5 years to respond for the wages and prices to fully respond and work through the supply chains to the overall economy. And that response, this is what this is based on. We assume, and we've told you a number of times, we assume that public sector money is spent, but the public sector impact is only on the demand side. Okay. You're hiring teachers, they're working, they get additional income, they spend it in different sectors, and so that works through the system. So it doesn't go away. But the teachers in this assumption, this simulation, don't have any impact on labor productivity. Okay, they're just demanders in the system.
Senator Bershiger, did you have something now?
Yeah, go ahead and finish, and then when he's done with
this. Okay, then we'll get to you. Okay, thanks.
So one of the things that we have in the OTIM model is what we call E-tags, which is an equation linking public sector spending with productivity in the economy. And we can vary that by sector, but we looked at adjusting E-tags, the coefficient, so we do get a productivity impact from public sector spending. And we increased it a moderate amount, and this has led to what we call simulation 4M. So 4M.
Sort of in the middle of our list.
Yes, 4M is, this is the simulation where everything else is the same, except we've adjusted the productivity variable to increase productivity in the public sector. So this works through all the sectors. It increases the productivity of the labor force in each of the sectors. Now, you could argue whether that's realistic or not, but it does give you a sense of what the broad effects would be. The first thing that happens is the nominal personal income goes from a -70 to a +91. So the kind of growth you get, though, is not really more jobs. If you look at the employment numbers, they go from a +7,500 to a +8,000. And really what we're doing here, the increase in productivity, it doesn't increase the number of workers, and it doesn't really increase the incentive of existing workers to work more. But what it does is increases the productivity of current workers. So the productivity of the current workers is increased, meaning they produce more. And that's what's generating the additional income in the system. So, and again, if you look at per capita is a -62. Under this one, it's a -30, so a much smaller decrease. If you look at investment, it goes from 33 to 44 million. Price level is not affected much. The return to capital is up slightly in this version, and the wage index doesn't decrease as much as it does in the initial simulation.
Chair, technical question.
Sorry.
Technical question.
Yes, Senator.
Could you re-explain, Paul, how or why productivity increases?
The product.
Why are workers suddenly going to be more productive?
The workers are more productive because of the investments made in the public sector. Those could take really two forms. One, as we've talked about, education. Educated workers are more productive. They're able to produce more per hour of work. That's why firms pay them more. The other one is through infrastructure, like transportation or other kind of infrastructure, which increases the productivity of capital. So that any amount of capital or labor you have is now more productive if it has a more efficient infrastructure.
My businesses haven't worked that way, but that's okay.
Yeah.
So. Oh, over here, Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Just following up on, I think Senator Boulquist's question was an excellent question, and the time frame in order to reap those benefits obviously that would be delayed. I mean, yes, we're trying to do a transportation package, but it would take. I'm wanting it done tomorrow, as many of us are, but that will take some time, and then the education investment. So, can you just explain a little bit more? I mean, I see what's here, but
tell us what the M means.
What?
Tell us what the M means.
Yes, what the M means. The M means medium term.
Yeah, no.
And the four is just, maybe we should put an S on that. That's the short term.
Okay.
But and that's exactly why we have made the decision in the past not to adjust this equation. Because we think, well, if you're looking 5 years and you can invest anything in early childhood education, which probably is not going to pay off for 20 years, versus something like community colleges, which may pay off in 5 years. So it really gets into the details of the ways and means process and where you're going to invest the money. So from our conceptual perspective, we see the ETAGS equation, the productivity equation, as reflective of a longer time period. And kind of what I'm thinking, when I don't have a lot of empirical evidence for this, but what I'm thinking in terms of the M is it's more like 10 years. So you're talking 5 years with the initial SIM. Now you're talking 10 years, and you're starting to see some of these benefits that accrue. Now, if you really want to get a detailed estimate, you're going to have to get a more detailed expenditure sector than what we have now.
Okay.
So we'd have to get LFO to do that.
Senator Bershinger?
It's an interim project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, in my real life, I work with modeling and programs on wildland fire and trying to predict all that. So I understand working with computer models. On these models that you're going over today with, what is the margin of error in the crystal ball?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Bretschinger, these are simulations. So they are not direct predictions. We're not substituting for what you heard on Tuesday. These are based on relationships that a lot of them are empirically driven. Some of them you have more empirical evidence than others, so the relationships are less well understood. But things like the labor supply curve is one of the biggest variables in it. How do workers respond to an increase in real wages? Well, we got a lot of empirical evidence on that. And so we have a pretty good idea if wage goes up a certain amount, what that's going to do. We have a lot of evidence on migration and how that's tied to the economy in and out of Oregon. It's obviously tied to our economic activity. If you go back to the early 80s, that was the only time we had out-migration. Why? Well, because there were no jobs here. The economy was doing so poorly. So we have that kind of evidence built into it. But we're not predicting a certain thing will happen. We're just saying that these policies will influence the overall forecast, which would include these other things that Mark McMullen was talking about on Tuesday.
So there's no margin of error? I mean,
there's not, Senator, there's not a...
quantifiable?
It's not quantifiable. There's not a... for example, we look at the standard deviation. We have to keep a standard deviation running of the general fund forecast. And we've got that all the way back to the history of the modern forecasting process in the 70s. And so we can see here's what they predicted, here's what happened. So we can do that kind of thing. But in order to look at this, we'd have to break out the current law forecast, what was the error there, versus what was the simulated error. So in short, we haven't been able to do that. That's a monumental task. The other thing, of course, that's happened is we haven't really had fundamental tax changes to predict for a long time. One of the things we did predict, and I think it pretty well has come about as we look at the evidence, is the impact of the single sales factor. We didn't predict that as generating, you know, a lot of overall employment, but we predicted it generating employment in the manufacturing sector and increasing those sectors in manufacturing, and indeed it did. Or at least that's been the response. Probably a number of other factors influenced it as well. But so we haven't had a major tax change that we could come back and look at and say, okay, here's the current law forecast, here's what OTIM said, and parcel that out. So maybe that's an argument for tax reform, so we could test to see.
Might be an interesting test.
Yes. Only an economist could come up with that particular answer.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Representative Fernandez, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a technical question, and it might be a leading question, then a follow-up, Chair. What happens to our economy when production decreases significantly?
Representative Fernandez, there are two ways we can have. I mean, it's just like two ways you can grow. There's two ways you can decline. One is you can have out-migration. So your labor force shrinks, or your labor force ages. And so if that occurs, then your baseline would go down. And one of the things that happens, for example, if we are to impose certain taxes, and it'll show up in OTIM, we'll have some out-migration. And so that would be less people here. The other effect is kind of the reverse of what we've looked at here, and that is productivity goes down. Productivity can go down. You can still have same level of employment, but your wages go down and your per capita income goes down. So, I mean, you can think of yourself as thinking about other countries with less capital, less educated workforces. They have plenty, lots of them have plenty of employment, but their wages are lower and their income is lower.
Follow-up? Yes.
Co-chair, and in line with the good vice chair, Boquist, Senator Boquist, I think we may be looking at the root cause of the problem a little differently. For me, I don't necessarily believe investing in public sector, public education is a problem per se. I think the root causes are what we're working on right now, our revenue systems and the structural problems in which not only our property tax system has, but are also our corporate income tax currently, and how that has created volatility in our public sectors that have impacted our productivity. For example, you know, I could own a home if I didn't have $70,000 in student debt, and that's because I went to public education here, University of Oregon, Portland State University, did student loans. And if tuition was lower, if we were really truly investing in our public education system, including higher education system, I could probably have a home at this moment and be paying property taxes and be much more productive, although I do pay other forms of taxes. But in my experience, the structural issues that I've seen has been more of the consequences of folks not graduating from school and because of our deteriorating public education system and the outcomes that we see and the correlation of our structural revenue system. That was more of a statement than a question.
I had a hard time discerning the question, but the statement was eloquent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Paul, the models you're showing us today have a 0.48% sales factor built into them. We received a proposal a couple of weeks ago for one virtually double that at 0.95. Will you be presenting us with models at that level and what impact it would have on employment and household incomes as well?
I can look at various rates. We can look at different rates, and we can look at also different combinations around the income tax changes as well. We've looked at those as well.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay. So just one final point is, as you looked at the impact of the on the dynamic impact, you just look at one more on that one. Chris, on the dynamic impact on revenue.
This is SIM4 long.
SIM4, this is SIM4 medium. Again, one last point. SIM4 had a minus $4 million on the dynamic feedback. So that meant there was a little less economic activity, so that the effect was minuscule, but still slightly negative. Now it's up to plus 18. So the enhanced economic activity, the higher wage level, the increased investment in the system has fed back and adds some revenue, some additional revenue to the static estimate. Now the 4L is where we have increased the coefficient and the productivity equation significantly, and it has pretty significant effects on the economy. Though, which I think is an interesting message, is not much on employment. Because remember, we talked about how does employment grow? Either you get more people moving into the state, and that, of course, creates demand. But also, if you have people with an incentive to work more, the more intense use of your labor force. So we don't have either one of those things happening here. We have more productivity in the economy, and that's pushing up employment slightly. But what's happening overall is income is up now by about $750 million compared to $90 million in the 4M simulation. Per capita is now up about $100 compared to minus 30 in the previous sim. Employment's up 10,400, so up slightly, and investment is up $89 million instead of $44 million in the medium term. So we're getting longer term investments that are translating into a more productive workforce, more intensive growth in the economy, meaning higher per capita income. And even the wage index, which was negative because of the increased labor supply, now becomes positive because it's got a lot more capital to work with. And that's where the productivity is showing through. And again, the return on capital is higher. The price level is slightly higher, but about 0.2 compared to 0.16 before. And now if you look at the dynamic effects, there's up $109 million is the dynamic revenue effect. And then if you go down and look at the boxes for, remember this is the box for the distribution of the tax burden. And basically the higher productivity has washed away the negative effects overall in the economy. And so you can see there's been an increase. We do have more households in the system, so there is some reduction in the mean income change per household, meaning the price effects. We have an increase in the price level that's relatively small. And you can see all household groups except the bottom group are benefiting. And what's happening is you've got a more educated labor force, more capital is in the system, and the benefits are actually more distributed toward the middle to upper side. And so that's, again, how the model's working. That would be something that policymakers would have to be aware of and think of in terms of overall economic growth. So normally economic growth occurs where you have more wages, more capital. It does tend to have this pattern of skewing toward the higher end. And you can see that in the OTEM results. But overall, household real disposable income, so this is after tax, after price and wage adjustments, is up $319 million in the 4L, whereas it's down $273 million in the original SIM. So that's the effect of the productivity side, is to increase wages, increase investment, and increase employment slightly, but mostly to get this intensive growth and increase the overall productivity of the system. In effect, it makes the economy more competitive relative to other states.
Well, if you consider that you're funding education, getting a workforce over the long term that is better able to compete in the worldwide economy, then that last statement of yours makes absolutely good sense, doesn't it? When you're in a, you've got more productive people, the chances of competing as the economy rapidly changes in the world goes up.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I think that's one of the lessons we've learned, certainly from globalization, is that it is more competitive now. And if you think about it, you don't really want, as a policymaker, you don't really want to compete on wages, because that's going to be, you know, you don't want to have the lowest wage to be competitive. So you're really trying to maximize your income, per capita income, and the way you do that is through a more educated, more productive labor force. And that's, historically, that's been the case.
I'd like to broaden the discussion just a little bit. These simulations are all essentially focused on changes in the tax system. I mean, there's some other ancillary parts that you've been describing. But they don't have anything to do they, with the continued capacity of our civilization to innovate, build more productive science and products that get better output for less energy and less labor, and less capital, perhaps. I mean, none of these simulations have nothing to do with any of those things, do they?
Mr. Co-Chair, I think I've mentioned several times in this committee Robert Gordon's recent book on history of U.S. productivity, and it looks at American productivity growth going back to 1870, and really traces through. And the most common factor that has driven growth is innovation, technological change. So we know that that is really the primary driver now. And a more educated labor force is able to implement that technology more effectively. But what generates these major technological changes? Well, I mean, I can be honest with you about the economics profession. We don't know. We know it's the most important factor in growth, but we don't know what triggers these big technological jumps.
Well, I think what we do know, anybody who's paying attention to the economic changes that are taking place here and around the world know that innovation is driving very, very quickly right now. Nobody knows what the next great innovation is going to be, but we absolutely expect them. Mm-hmm. And of course, I don't think that has anything to do with economics or your area of expertise, but it's simply a sweep of history at this moment. Mm-hmm. Your comment about an educated workforce being able to accommodate those changes and benefit from them, I think, makes absolutely good sense. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, thanks for all the work. Some have said that Oregon is a business-unfriendly state, and there's a list of things under that heading. You're aware of them as much as anyone. How many of those negatives are factored into your model?
Mr. Co-Chair, Vice Chair Benz, you know, our model is based on historical relationships. So, I mean, it is built in terms of the where we start from. So, it's built into this baseline equilibrium in a sense. So, it's just like, and we've talked about this in terms of the tax structure, which of course we focus on, or the distribution of the tax burden. We're always looking at changes, and the fact is, our distribution of our tax burden is quite a bit different than other states. And so we should always keep in mind about where we're starting from. But this model is just looking at changes from where we are, or changes where we are from the current law forecast. So it's only in the sense it's built into the baseline. We're not assuming that there's some kind of a change in land use policy or more less regulatory structure. We're assuming we're holding all those things constant when we make this change.
Some of the things I've observed over the 10 years I've been here are just now starting to kick in, many of them having to do with the environment and additional costs that are imposed upon activities in the state. And so those might not necessarily be reflected in your baseline because they're new.
Yes.
So in order to – and modeling is always interesting, but I often wonder how much weight to truly give it. And I think someone asked earlier, what's the margin of error? I guess another way of putting the same question would be, how much weight should we give this this exercise?
Vice Chair Benson, you know, the focus of our model has always been on tax policy and how tax policy might change where your economy ends up relative to the current law forecast. So it's looking at the marginal impact of tax changes, holding other things constant. So it's only one small piece of what, you know, what's going to be factors in whether the economy stays competitive or what our relative growth rate's going to be. There's a whole series of policies that you're involved in making at the state level, but a whole series of other things well outside state policy that's going to influence that. And, you know, I mean, the conclusion, I think, and I've said this a number of times, the conclusion about tax, state and local tax policy is that it, you know, if you look at the empirical evidence, conclusion is it does matter, depending on the structure you have or where you implement it. It's a border area, that kind of thing. But it generally doesn't matter very much in terms of the overall magnitude of things. The growth of our economy is going to be driven by factors way beyond your state tax policy. But I do think this is one of the factors that will influence growth over time. And certainly the level of public sector investment in things does influence where you end up in a competitive position. I did have an opportunity to work in the Deep South for a number of several years, and you could see how lack of investment in education affected the competitiveness of the state. It was very clearly reflected in the wage level and the per capita income of the state.
A brief follow-up. Your remarks remind me of something said in one of our, I think, Economic Development Committee some years ago when we were considering the unfortunate per capita income position we enjoy relative to Washington State. Mm-hmm. And when I asked the economist what we could do about it, he said nothing. Nothing. Get used to it. That was a bad answer, and so thank you for your work.
But I think there is definitely things you can do. I think that certainly in the long term, the policies you enact will influence where this, you know, the overall destination of the state. But there's just, you know, the fact of the matter is a lot of other bigger forces are out there that are going to have a more likely have a bigger influence.
Mm-hmm. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the things I just heard you say, I think, is that other policy committees may have as much or more influence over what really drives the economy in the state than what we're doing in this committee.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Riley, that's possible, certainly, and I think the whole array of state and local policies do have an impact on long-term growth, not just taxes, but I think taxes do, and I think the evidence supports that. But also, I'm saying things way beyond state and local government affect the growth of the state, and in particular, the federal government policy, too, has a significant effect, not only in overall growth, which is the best predictor of Oregon's growth is going to be U.S. growth, is also the regional distribution, because those policies at the federal level do affect the distribution of economic activity across the country.
Thank you. Senator Bershiger, please.
Thank you. Kind of to piggyback on the good co-chair's conversation about education, and I couldn't agree more, education does play a part. I'm worried about the entrepreneurs. We talk about, you know, this group of people, this, and the difficulties they have. I look at my career. I've been an entrepreneur all my life, starting clear back in my teens. And now my sons are doing it, and they have multiple businesses. They could not do what they're doing today if it wasn't for me supporting them. They could not do what I did 40 years ago. Okay, and I really worry about that. It is, and everybody at this dais is actually responsible for some of that. We've put in entry-level barriers. We've put in barriers so they do not have access to capital. And this affects our young people and our most vulnerable people to get started. And I think everybody at this dais is responsible in one way or other of putting those barriers in. And if we would focus more at reducing these barriers, we would encourage and we would see these entrepreneurs start taking off. If you go back to the Industrial Revolution, those people were entrepreneurs and they did not have any of the regulations or entry-level barriers we have today. And I think that that is as important as the education piece. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Taylor.
Oh, thank you, Chair Barnhart. I just wanted to make just a quick comment on that. I believe that the reason why Representative Barnhart and Senator Haass brought us together here is that we're talking about tax reform. And I'm just curious about, I do not know in my professional work, and I've never seen any article ever written where any other state is wanting to copy, although I consider us a great state in many ways, no one's ever wanted to copy Oregon's tax structure. So there is a reason we are all here. And so it's not easy, and there's going to be some give and take and a little bit of push and pull here, but we're going to need to come up with some changes because we're hitting this breaking point in certain areas, and schools are one of them. We have some social service needs. We have some things here where we need to change how our tax structure works, and it's not just about money coming into the state coffers. It's also about money that is available for our local governments. In addition, and some of the decisions we make here and through our initiative process has had the, you know, has had impacts in different levels of government. So, unless Mr. Warner knows of someone calling his office and saying, "Please, we'd like to do what you do in Oregon." So,
Mr. Chair,
no,
could I have a response from Dr. Warner? It was kind of a question in my statement about the barriers and how that affects.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe we missed it. I didn't introduce a question, but.
I didn't do a very good job.
Do you want to try again?
Yes. How do those entry level barriers and just regulations basically affect this entrepreneur group?
Senator Barrett here. Yeah, the entrepreneur is another one of those elements. That we know is very important in terms of part of the innovation process and the dynamism of the economy in general. There's always one of the basic assumptions about a competitive system is that you minimize barriers to entry. And barriers to entry can be, and Adam Smith said that there's always those that are in the industry are always trying to create those barriers to keep others out. So there is that kind of conflict that goes on. And sometimes they try to use the government to do that. And you can see, various price fixing and those kinds of things. So I think that's definitely true. When you have the kind of dynamic companies that we've seen worldwide, Microsoft being one that, and you've seen Google that's become huge in terms of its capitalized value, we're seeing those are still, a lot of them are American-based. And so you do see America still is driving a lot of the world dynamism of the world economy in that respect for those innovative industries. And you see sectors or parts of the world where you see more regulation, more limitations on labor practices, on product standards, and so forth. And most people look to Europe, and you see, along with the demographics, you see that as one of the reasons for slower growth in Europe. So I think those general trends are true. I think, however, you're always, from a public policy standpoint, you're mixing, some of this dynamism with some of the non-market effects that come into play. And that's where, environmental policy comes into effect, public safety policy in general. So it's one of the tricks of public policy is matching those two and finding the right combination of them. And there certainly are trade-offs. I mean, the more restrictive you are, you may be limiting entrepreneurial and innovation activity. On the other hand, you may be generating a greater public good outside the market. So those are tough calls to make, and that's one of the public policy decisions that has to be made.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair. To generalize on this concept of barriers to entry, is it unfair to also classify in there a lack of access to Head Start programs for struggling families or high teacher-child ratios in elementary school, or to harken back to the comment on college tuition, high barriers to actually being able to afford college. I mean, aren't those, generally speaking, significant barriers to entry?
Representative Marsh, yes, absolutely. When we look at these income blocks here in the OTIM output, for the different levels, whatever the level is at a point in time and how evenly or unequally it's distributed is an important policy issue for a number of reasons. But One of the factors to also keep in mind is not just these the numbers in these blocks, but are people moving through those blocks of income? And that's where you get into this. Do you have a dynamic economy where somebody can start out at the low end, and do they have the opportunity to get educated and trained and then be successful in the market and then move up? So you have that kind of a mobility within those income groups. So those are really kind of two different issues. But the ability for lower income folks to have access to education, to human capital investment, and if you're a small business, to have access to financial capital to start a business, those are all real important factors in mobility.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I was listening to the comments of folks up here, I started thinking back to 1977 when the Portland Trail Blazers were playing, and everyone said that there would never be another Dr. J. And then in 1984, I was told there would never be another Magic Johnson. And then you realize in the 90s, we were told there would never be another Michael Jordan. And gosh, right now we've got LeBron James. The reason I share that is in our economy, entrepreneurs will figure out a way to rise to the top. That's what entrepreneurs do. And so I kind of want to associate with Senator Taylor and her comments in that there's moderation that needs to be had in this process. I also want to associate with your comments, Paul, in that education is a key to success. If anyone wants to see a microcosm of this, come to the Port of Morrow. Come to Morrow County. Morrow County is sand, but it's a blooming sand now. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, they've invested in education. There's not a school bond in Morrow County that doesn't get passed. Okay? There's not a health bond that doesn't get passed. There's not a levy for helping out the kids that doesn't get passed. And so there's a real mentality of Morrow County, you invest in yourself. Second, I'd share with you is, again, there's a microcosm going on at the Port of Morrow in that they invest in their own infrastructure. One of the things I view that we ought to be doing as a state is, yes, tax policy is critical, but we need to have a tax policy that allows us to invest in ourselves. When all these other little rural communities are dying and the sand pit out in Boardman is blooming, it's because they've invested in the basic infrastructure. They've made those investments on the front end. And I think we have a chance now with this committee, with the Transportation Committee, and some of the other work going on to make these investments today that will pay off 20 years from now. And so I would hope that we don't get out on the fringes. We stay in a position to where we just make common sense, rational investments and realize that if we do it, who knows who will be the next LeBron 10, 15 years from now. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Barnhart. I'm going to just add on to Representative Smith. You know, the top entrepreneurial city in the country is Bend, Oregon right now, creating more new jobs than almost any equivalent metro area in the whole nation. And it's a real model of what's been going on. And Representative Smith is exactly right. You know, there's seven underlying factors that increase the entrepreneurial and startup activity. Education, infrastructure are certainly two of them, but it's also an entrepreneurial culture. It's supporting, creating a culture for business success. It's access to capital, which what we're doing here right now is really important, because if capital doesn't want to flow into an area, that innovation goes elsewhere. It's quality of life. It's an innovation engine, so our university specifically creating new ideas and new products. And all those things need to combine to create the right environment, which includes laws and regulations. You want to stifle that innovation. And it's particularly important because existing firms, large firms, don't generate that many jobs, right? They shed jobs. And new jobs are created with the startup activity. But I'm still asking the chief question here, and this is a great discussion. I think it's something we need to have. You know, what problem set are we trying to solve here? Are we trying to solve stability or adequacy or both? And I think certainly this is one way to deal with those problem sets. And I think we all agree that they need to be talked about. But I think there's also other solutions
specifically to the stability issue that we're not talking about, mainly enhancing a rainy day.
Thank you. Those are not really questions for our nonpartisan economists, but they are great questions for the committee and for the legislature as a whole. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciated Senator Taylor's comments about economists not writing glowing reviews of our tax structure, but I go back to Tuesday, and Representative Smith and I were sitting together while the chief economist was presenting his data to us, but it was really glaring to both of us, I think, that as you look at how our current tax structure produces revenue, it does a really good job during good economic times. We far exceed national growth in revenues. But what's been missing is fiscal discipline during those times to be able to save so that we have resources available when the economy isn't as red hot and rolling, to go back to a basketball analogy here that we heard from Representative Smith. But as we go forward, I mean, whatever tax policy we end up changing or modifying or whatever, it needs to go hand in hand with some sound fiscal policy as well. So just a statement, not a question, but I think they need to go hand in hand.
Other comments? Senator Boquist.
Thank you. I think Representative Smith raises the key, probably the most important point on education that's been made today, and that is that quality education gets results. And I just remind all of you that I guess haven't been on the revenue committees for a long time, the school formula equalizes a lot of that payment structure. So it's the quality schools that you see out in Representative Smith's district with local input, local leadership, and equal resources that are making the difference. My contention, once again, after 12 years of observing our debates here, is that there's absolutely probably no doubt in my mind that in Representative Smith's district, they focus on early education and quality early education. And they take the resources they give, they're equal to everybody else, and they focus it there. My point is, there is a balance between the amount of resources you provide and the quality that you have in the school. It is not just throw money at the problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm going to add a couple of comments that I think my perspective.
You text between each other.
My perspective goes back to 1993. I frankly wasn't paying much attention to schools before that time, because in Eugene we had excellent schools and they just worked, and I was a graduate of South Eugene High School in 1964, one of the best high schools in the country at that time, with great outcomes. When we cut property taxes in a major way in the 90s, we upset the stability and the structure of our revenue system that supported schools. And nothing we have seen since then has replaced the negative impacts of those revenue cuts. Some areas have been fortunate and have done excellent planning, and I'm sorry he left, but I was going to compliment Representative Smith and Morrow County for having figured out how to operate on limited funds and also how to operate around the current negative structures in our tax system in order to get the outcomes that they want. Other areas of the state have not been so fortunate. And I would like the committee and the legislature and the public to consider the long-term perspective that Oregon has faced. I am here because obviously I've been winning elections, but the reason that I wanted to win elections was because I wanted to work on this school funding structural problem that arose in 1990 and 1996 and 97, and that we have never fixed. The very best years that we have had with good revenue, the very best years that we have had, have not provided the funds in those years to provide the educational opportunities generally available in the state in 1989. They were not that good. Now, I don't disagree with anything that Representative Johnson has said about the need for fiscal prudence and stability. Completely agree with those points. And in fact, the legislatures that I've been in the last several years and that most of us here have been in the last several years have done what's possible to maintain and develop a rainy day fund or a set of rainy day funds that have more dollars in them than was possible in the past. I also think that we should be commending the legislatures that met immediately after Measure 5 passed and that we're dealing with the emergency and that adopted the formula that we used to distribute the state school fund. I thought that was prescient, and it has prevented us from facing a worse catastrophe than Oregon has faced. The fact that a catastrophe is slow-moving, that it takes time to happen, doesn't make it any less a catastrophe. Our dropout rate is enormous. That isn't just because money has somehow been mismanaged. It's because we cut the funding, and the school system has done an absolutely tremendous job around the state of doing what's possible with the resources that are available. It is imperative that we find a way to increase the resources that are available if we want the kinds of outcomes statewide that Representative Smith referred to having in Morrow County. There is no solution that doesn't involve raising revenue to pay for those things. And I also agree with Senator Boquist. Absolutely, the money needs to be spent well. It needs to be spent in ways that actually get outcomes that we need. But doing that without adequate resources is simply a way of moving the deck chairs around as the ship of state slowly sinks under the waves. Oregon's been very fortunate. We've been growing on a wave of innovation and change and in-migration of educated people who make up for the fact that we're doing a less good job than we should about educating our own members, our own residents. But how long is that going to continue? Who knows? And what about the gigantic number of children who live in poverty, partly because their parents don't have the education they need in order to get good jobs, which is, I think, among the highest one or two in the country now? How about our housing shortage problem? How about the problem we have with low-income Oregonians becoming an increasingly large percentage of the total population? My view is that it all comes back to the decisions made in the 90s when Oregon decided that it was no longer going to support the most basic services that government is to provide. Let me finally close my comment by saying the genius of the United States, these are things everyone knows, the genius of the United States is the public school system. We invented it. The capacity of the United States to win two world wars, to be the economic engine even today of the entire world, it comes about directly as a result of the fact that it's our policy that every kid gets educated and that it be done in a free public education paid for by public taxes. Other countries have adopted this model since then and have prospered as a result, but we're the place where it was invented. I don't want us to be the place that first stops doing it, either by attrition, as we've been doing it, or by policy. That's why I'm here. That's why I wanted to chair the House Committee on Revenue and be a co-chair of this committee. And whatever it is we do, I certainly hope that among the things we do this session is move us a little closer to that point where we are a self-sustaining, where we are able to self-sustain these very basic services, especially education. Now, Representative Buehler, did you have an additional comment?
Just a question for Paul, please.
Please.
Yeah.
And then we have to go.
Paul, the assertion from Chair Barnhart and his very heartfelt comments is that the per capita spending in Oregon per capita government, local and state, is markedly below other states?
No, frankly, it's not. That is not what I'm saying. The fact that other states may underfund their education system has nothing to do with the reality that Oregon needs to fund ours.
And that's not my question. My question is, how does Oregon rank compared to other states on per capita government spending, local and state? Are we middle of the pack? Are we the top quartile, bottom quartile?
I can get that data for you, Representative Buehler, with the census data, and I'll just probably best thing to do would be to bring that. It depends on the measure you use. There's a general measure that includes trust fund spending, and then there's a general spending level that includes all sources, and then there's an own source. What do you spend from your own revenue sources? I'll bring those all and show you the rankings. I have a big spreadsheet, and I can. It ranks everything. So I'll bring that for the committee.
Thank you. Thank you so much. House members, be aware we're meeting this afternoon at 1 o'clock. We're going to deal with all those work sessions that we put off. Senator Pass, do you have a closing comment?
Just that on Tuesday, when we have the bill, at some point we have to get the legislation, and it will have some I just don't want people to think that this is any more than the bumble play on the potter's wheel. The rates will be blank, so we need to start with something. So,
and as Senator Hess indicated, we will be meeting again Tuesday morning. Thank you very much for using the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee time for this committee. We appreciate it. With that, the committee's adjourned. With that, the committee's adjourned.